When people think about the causes of cancer, they might think of lifestyle factors such as smoking, or genetic causes like the BRCA gene, which makes some people more susceptible to breast cancer. Microbes are not usually the first thing to come to mind, but should they be? It's becoming increasingly clear that the diseases caused by microbes extend well past simple infections. And now, a growing number of bacteria, viruses, and fungi are being linked to tumours. I'm Laura, and you're listening to Microbe Talk, the podcast from the Microbiology Society. For a while now, the link between certain viruses and cancer has been well known. One example is human papillomavirus, or HPV. HPV can cause a number of cancers, including cervical cancer. In 2008, a vaccine to protect against HPV was introduced for teenage girls across the UK. And 11 years later, it was announced that 12 to 13-year-old boys in the UK would also be offered the vaccine. But how exactly do viruses cause cancer? I'm with Paul Farrell, Professor of Tumour Virology at Imperial College London. Paul's main research area is on Epstein-Barr virus, or EBV. EBV causes mono, which we know as glandular fever here in the UK. Paul, whilst I was doing some research ahead of this podcast, I read your review, Epstein-Barr Virus and Cancer, which was brilliant. That review said that EBV contributes to 1.5% of all human cancers worldwide. How many viruses are out there contributing to the development of cancers?
If you add all the other viruses together, you know, you've got about one cancer in six of all cancers worldwide has got a virus involved in the etiologies. It's, that's kind of one of the reasons why it's an important and interesting area. You know, we spend a tremendous amount of time looking for new drugs to treat cancer, when what we should really be doing, of course, is preventing cancers or identifying them very early. You know, the possibility of immunizing against the virus, which is required for cancer development, is an obvious thing to do, if possible. And has actually been achieved, of course, with hepatitis B and human papillomaviruses. And the immunization works, basically. It prevents the disease.
And how effective are vaccines against cancer-causing viruses?
In England, for example, hepatitis B infection is not very common. And it's, with those hepatitis viruses, it's only when you get a chronic infection that you have a risk of, you know, chronic liver damage and a risk of cancer. But in the Far East, they're extremely important infectious agents, and the primary liver cancer associated with hepatitis B was very big in Southeast Asia. And the classic first ever demonstration of prevention of disease in these virus-associated cancers was done with hepatitis B. I think the vaccine was introduced in 1984 in Taiwan. And there's some wonderful data basically showing that when the immunization program is introduced, then the rate of infection drops. And then, you know, because it takes a long time to develop cancer, enough time has now elapsed so that we can see that the rate of liver cancer has dropped. And then basically that was kind of followed and eventually resulted in the HPV vaccines that we see now. We know that the HPV vaccines prevent the precursor stages of cancer, and it's extremely confident that it will therefore prevent the cancer, the cervical cancers. But in fact, the lead time between infection of the HPV and the development of cancer is still quite long, still maybe 20 years. So, yeah, we're kind of doing the experiment in the population at the moment, but we're extremely confident that it is going to prevent cervical cancer and other HPV-associated cancers as well. I think there's a significant number of tonsillar carcinomas associated with HPV, and so I think it will eventually prevent those as well.
You mentioned just then that the lead time from infection to development of cancer is around 20 years. So what happens during that time?
It's a general feature of development of cancer that, you know, it's primarily a disease of old people because it just takes a long time to accumulate all the errors in a single cell, which will allow it to escape the normal growth regulations. And generally speaking, be 6 to 10 or 12, things have all got to go wrong in a cell. The way to look at it is that infection by the virus just happens to do things to the cell which overcome some of those obstacles, but not all of them. Viruses with DNA genomes, the primary evolutionary pressure on the virus is to make more virus, and so they've got to replicate their genomes, and it's just a fact that deoxythymidine triphosphate that you need to make new DNA is only made in S phase of the cell cycle, G1 and S phase of the cell cycle. So it's not surprising, therefore, that many DNA viruses have got genes in them which tend to push cells into the active part of the cell cycle. So they need the cells to replicate, basically, in order to be able to replicate themselves. And so in many of the viruses, you'll have genes which do that.
Would the immune system not clear these viruses out within 20 years?
Some of the DNA viruses are also able to make very long-term infections. Epstein-Barr virus, for example, is one of the herpes virus family. You know, that's what herpes viruses do. Like, once you're infected, then you just carry the virus for the rest of your life. And they normally hide away pretty silently. But it also gives them the opportunity to continue to contribute to malignant change. So we can kind of see two ways that viruses can contribute to cancer broadly. One is this idea that they'll express genes which just help to push the cells towards the cancerous state. The second way is that the virus may cause chronic damage to the infected organ, and that may cause the organ to renew, resulting in exceptional degree of cell division where you can accumulate errors in the cells. So that's particularly relevant in the liver cancers. Hepatitis B and hepatitis C, they both infect the liver and cause inflammation. So if you get infected with one of those, then more than likely you will resolve the infection. Your immune system will overcome the viral infection, and that's fine. You'll recover and you won't have any risk of cancer. But if you get a chronic infection, you know, unlike if the surgeon cuts your hand off, you don't grow a new one. But if he cuts half your liver away, you actually grow your liver back to replace the organ. And so that's a lot of unscheduled cell division. So there's really two ways in which the viruses contribute. One is they may have specific gene products which manipulate the cell towards a dividing state. And the other is they may chronically damage an organ which causes unscheduled DNA replication.
Epstein-Barr virus is quite a common virus and usually doesn't cause significant harm in healthy people. How has this virus been linked to tumours in immunocompromised people?
So for the Epstein-Barr virus, it's exceptional because it's a kind of strange kind of virology, I usually like to say with it. So you're used to the idea that you infect cells with a virus, the virus replicates and kills the cell. But Epstein-Barr virus isn't organised that way. So when it's kind of transmitted in saliva, when mother kisses baby, let's say. And what it's trying to do is to get into your B lymphocytes, and it's going to hide away. So there's lots of lymphoid tissue in your oropharynx, your tonsils and adenoids, and it can just briefly replicate in the surface epithelium, and then it gets into the B cells. It doesn't immediately then replicate virus. It starts expressing some of its genes, which, you know, if you think about what a resting B cell is meant to do, it's sitting there waiting to see its antigen. And if it happens to meet its antigen, it's going to become activated and head off to the lymph node and try and do, you know, improve its immune response and so on. And EBV basically tricks the cell into thinking that's what's happened. And you can see that in culture. So if you take uninfected lymphocytes from my blood, let's say, and they're just kind of sitting there, they're resting cells waiting to see antigen. If you infect them with EBV, they just grow permanently in the lab. They don't make any EBV, but they maintain the copy number of the virus inside the cells, and the virus expresses a few of its genes, and that just drives proliferation of the cell. So that's not a problem to me, because I'm a normal immune competent person. My immune system recognizes those infected cells and just kills them. But if you were immune suppressed, maybe you just had a transplant, and so you've been given immunosuppressive drugs, and then you get a primary EBV infection, and that drives proliferation of your cells. And it's a very frequent problem in transplant programs, is the immunoblastic lymphomas.
So does that mean that Epstein-Barr is only associated with cancer in immunocompromised people?
So we just talked about the cancers in immunosuppressed people, and then we talked about a non-cancer condition, the glandular fever. In addition to those, in regular immunocompetent people, there's a whole range of other cancers which are associated with EBV. Several of those are lymphomas, which derive in different ways from B lymphocytes. So the best known is Burkitt's lymphoma, which is relatively frequent in sub-Saharan Africa when malaria is hyperendemic, in fact. And EBV plays a role in the development of that disease. And then there's another completely unrelated disease in southern China called this. So now we're not in lymphocytes, we're in, it's called nasopharyngeal carcinoma. It's in the back of the nose, basically. And when you look in the cancers, every cancer has got EBV in it. And then another one is stomach cancer. About 8% of stomach cancers have got, they're basically a different disease development from the rest, and they've got EBV in them contributing to the disease as well. So there's a lot of scope there where you can imagine immunization could possibly, you know, protect people. Or the presence of the virus could be used for early diagnosis, which is very important.
And what does your research into Epstein-Barr virus involve?
One area that we've been working on the lab in recent years is we're puzzled by the fact that some of the cancers associated with EBV have these remarkably different geographic distributions. And we do know environmental factors likely determine that. But you have to wonder if the EBV might be a bit different as well, and that's, you know, contributing to it. So we've been sequencing the viral genomes from different parts of the world, trying to understand whether that is likely to be the case. We can see lots of geographic variation, but we're looking specifically for cancer-associated variation, and we have been able to find some small sequence differences, single nucleotide polymorphisms, which seem to be associated with that. So that's the kind of ongoing work we're trying to do.
Viruses aren't the only microbes that have been linked to cancer. Researching links between the gut microbiome and disease has found that some bacteria have characteristics that could increase a person's risk of developing cancer. For example, some bacteria produce carcinogenic metabolites. Others might cause chronic inflammation, which, like Paul mentioned earlier, can increase the risk of cells mutating and becoming cancerous. One bacterium that has been linked to cancer is Helicobacter pylori, which causes stomach ulcers. I spoke with Dr. Karen Robinson, Associate Professor at the University of Nottingham's Biomedical Research Centre, to find out more. So Karen, could you tell us a little about Helicobacter pylori?
Helicobacter pylori is a bacterial pathogen, so it causes disease. It colonises the stomach of nearly half the people in the world. Years ago, almost everybody would have had these bacteria in their stomachs, but now it's becoming less common. And we think it's becoming less common because people are receiving antibiotics very frequently when they're young children. So people first get infected with Helicobacter as children when their acid levels in their stomach are not as harsh as they are when you grow up. So the bacteria can survive in there and adhere to the stomach lining. And once they've done that, they stay there. So most people don't have any symptoms. They don't know that there's a problem. But in about 10% of people who have it, they get ulcers in their stomach or their duodenum, and it can cause gastric cancer. It's the main cause of these diseases, and gastric cancer is a terrible disease to be diagnosed with. People don't know they've got the infection. They've had it all their lives, and usually it's sort of when they're 60 years old plus. Suddenly they start to have problems, their food won't go down properly, and it turns out after investigations in hospital that they've got a big tumour in their stomach often. And by the time it's got to that point, it's usually spread elsewhere in the body. And so about half the people who have this as a diagnosis die within a year.
These bacteria must be pretty hardy to survive for so long in the stomach.
They live in a thick mucus layer that's part of the stomach lining. So stomach acid in humans is very harsh, very, very harsh. Bacteria can't survive there at all. And one of the reasons it's there is to stop us getting infections through food. So it survives because It's got a few special tricks up its sleeve. So it's got flagella at one end, and it uses those flagella to propel it through the mucus layer so that it hides deep under that mucus and the acid doesn't get that far through, so it can sit there in a better environment. And it also produces a lot of urease. So this is an enzyme that it uses to split something called urea, which is in tissue fluid, and it uses that to make ammonia to buffer and counteract the acid pH. So it gets as fast as it can out of the stomach lumen and into the mucus layer in the lining, and then it makes this urease enzyme, a huge cloud of it, so that it's not going to be in a difficult environment.
And what happens once Helicobacter has embedded itself in the stomach lining?
Helicobacter sits there for decades. It sits there for most of a person's life. But actually, it's not a very nice environment for the bacteria to survive in. So even though you think, oh, well, I'm eating lots of rich food all the time, so surely the bacteria can have some of my food and are using that. That's not the case, because it's in this gel. Nutrients don't really get to it very easily. So to be able to stay there, it does a bit of damage to its host. So it's causing inflammation, and it causes the epithelial cells to sort of loosen their grip on each other, and then you get some tissue fluid seeping out where the Helicobacter are swimming. So they need to do a bit of damage to you to be able to survive there. They also need access to that urea, which is in the tissue fluid, so they need to do a bit of damage to get that as well. And that damage triggers inflammation.
How has Helicobacter been linked to gastric cancers?
There are several causes of gastric cancer and several types of different types of gastric cancer. We think Helicobacter infections are responsible for about 3/4 of them. So it's the leading cause. There are two different types of cancer that are linked to Helicobacter, and one of them isn't so bad. And in fact, you can get rid of that cancer by just giving antibiotics to eradicate the infection. So that's the only example I know of where you can cure cancer with antibiotics. So that type of cancer is called a Moult lymphoma, and it happens because immune cells, a particular type of immune cells called B cells, in the stomach lining and the tissue underlying that, start to grow in response to having Helicobacter there, and they grow in an uncontrolled way. So you get these big sort of pockets of dividing B cells in the stomach, and they cause inflammation and cause people to feel symptoms from it. If it just stays in the stomach, you can treat it with antibiotics and people don't need anything else. But if it spreads to lymph nodes and things, then it's more of a problem. The other kind of cancer is the one that kills people. So this is gastric adenocarcinoma. And adenocarcinomas arise from changes in the epithelial cells on the surface of the stomach lining. But where you've got chronic inflammation lasting a very long time, the inflammation can stop cells from undergoing the normal cycle of division and cell death. So, and it also can cause cells to start to behave in a different way.
So people who've had stomach ulcers in the past are infected with Helicobacter. Does that mean that they're more at risk of developing gastric cancer in the future?
It doesn't necessarily. There are so many things about Helicobacter that we don't really understand. But there are different patterns in the stomach of where the bacteria colonise, and that dictates what kind of disease you might be likely to have. One pattern of the disease leads to an increase in stomach acid and damage in the duodenum and then duodenal ulcers. If you have that pattern, you're really not likely at all to get cancer. It's bad news to have an ulcer, but you're not going to get cancer. But if you have the other pattern, that is associated with both with stomach ulcers and with gastric cancer. The odds of getting cancer are quite low, so only 1 to 5%.
And what does your research into Helicobacter pylori involve?
I work with clinicians so that we have access to material from patients who are suffering from these diseases. But I also work with basic scientists. We have people in the group who are gastroenterologists, microbiologists, immunologists. We have people who are experts in molecular biology and drug delivery, cancer specialists, pathologists. We work on epidemiology, neurology and computer science. So we've got a big network of people who are all contributing to our research, and we really need it because it's such a complicated and difficult problem to solve. And one of the big questions for us is obviously, why is this unlucky person got disease when most people don't have it at all? Improving treatments could help, but really it's figuring out how to get to people early enough. If it's diagnosed early, then the chances of survival are much better. So this big consortium of people that I work with are trying to address that. We've got lots of collaborators. We are trying to put together a picture, really, of what's going on in the people who are on a pathway towards developing cancer. So what are the characteristics of their strains? What are the characteristics of their immune response and their inflammatory response to the strain? Because that's really important too. And also we're interested in sort of lifestyle of people as well. So do they smoke, for instance? We've been building up a collection of material for about 20 years now. And with collaborators from other countries as well, we've got lots and lots of samples. All it can help us to do is build up a picture of what changes with sort of the severity of somebody's condition.
And that's all we've got time for this month. We've only scratched the surface of how microbes are linked to cancer, but I hope you found this episode interesting. If you want to find out more, I will leave some links to resources on cancer-causing microbes in the podcast description below. A huge thank you to Professor Paul Farrell and Dr. Karen Robinson for speaking with me for this episode and for all of their help. We will be back next month for another episode of Microbe Talk. But if you can't wait that long, keep an eye out for this month's episode of Micro News, where Matt and I will discuss some of the times that microbiology has been in the news over the past month. Thanks for listening to Microbe Talk, the podcast from the Microbiology Society.